dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A feature of this program is the opportunity we have each week to take advantage of the intelligence of a remarkable woman. Her name is Diana West. She is the author of three terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and The Red Thread. She blogs at dianawest.net and is a longtime syndicated columnist and resource for many of us on matters involving national security and particularly how it has been undermined over the years by our elites, which is a perfect backdrop to what I'm anxious to talk with Diana about today. Diana, welcome back. It's so good to have you. Let me talk to you about the president's address yesterday and the press interactions he had on the margins of it at the White House. And as I think you're aware, it was basically a throwdown on China. And he went through at length the various things that the Chinese have done to harm us as a people, as a nation, our alliance relationships, and so on over the years, aided and abetted by our own country's government in many cases, including notably that of Barack Obama and Joe Biden. And he specifically called out Joe Biden about his role in enabling some of this. And I wondered what your sort of take is on both the importance of that challenge and hopefully the very important decisions that the American people will shortly be making about who should be our next commander-in-chief and what policies they should be following.
Absolutely, because this articulation by President Trump is one of the, well, many stakes, but one of the larger stakes that he holds to go through the vampire of the uniparty that has been controlling the swamp in Washington really ever since Richard Nixon normalized relations with China. This is a, I would say, very clearly a bipartisan march through our institutions led at the top to join with China, to try to change China with all of these connections, trade, massive exchanges that have built up this dire threat. And we have some who are the fellow travelers pushing this more on the Democrat side. We would have others who saw this engagement, perhaps believing it to be a more benign way to change China. All of it a disaster, but all of it a shared crime, in a sense. And Donald Trump is calling this out. Now it's represented certainly by Biden and his party as being the party of China. And he made this completely clear to the American people. It's a very stark choice in terms of not just choosing between the two parties and the two standard bearers of the party, the president and Joe Biden, respectively, but really choosing between the security of our nation, represented by Donald Trump, and this continued treasonous kind of engagement, represented by Joe Biden.
Diana West, one of the things that particularly moved me about this event was a comment the president made in response to a question from the press to the effect of, are you going to be doing something to stop U.S. investments in Chinese defense companies? And we've been talking about this a lot in the Committee on the Present Danger, China, which you remember, and we've been warning about the need to end that kind of underwriting of the most immediate of the threats that we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party. And the president said, yes, American investors should not be putting their money into such defense companies, and that he's going to be doing things to try to stop that. It's a really important development, I think. And it comes at the moment that other steps are being taken as well, including, we're told, by an undersecretary of state by the name of Keith Karsh to essentially terminate a memorandum of understanding that Joe Biden helped engineer back in May of 2013 with the Chinese Communist Party that enabled their companies, defense companies, yes, and others, human rights violators, sanctioned companies, and many more, to have access to our capital markets, from which by some estimates they've extracted $3 trillion without having to play by our rules. And ending that memorandum of understanding would be a huge step forward in trying to stop that. What do you make of that? And the fact that, as the president mentioned in his press conference, shortly after he engineered that deal, his son gets $1.5 billion from the Chinese communists. So it seems like a kind of a commission on a $3 trillion transaction, don't you think?
Oh, it's stomach-turning, and it's such a scandal that, again, Donald Trump is bringing to the American people to again, up or down on this kind of life-saving program. I mean, this is shameful, and it's shocking that this is even in any kind of contention, that this is not just completely clear to policymakers that this is the way to go forward in order just to survive. I mean, it's astonishing how far we've fallen in terms of these kinds of arrangements, and pushed by Joe Biden, and that the Democratic Party thinks it's great. I mean, this is
well,
amazing.
And so do a lot of people, let's be honest, on Wall Street, who might be Republicans, I don't know, and some in Congress as well. But the truth of the matter is, and this is what Donald Trump, I think, has divined so accurately, is the American people will not stand for it. And this is where we, I think, will really see the test this fall. And Diana, you also mentioned to me one of the things that we prize about our visits with you each week are your insights from history that is largely forgotten by most of us. Mention Joe Biden's start and the role played in it by another communist enterprise, then known as the Soviet Union.
Yes, well, just very quickly, his beginnings in politics were greatly enhanced by groups and people very much associated with the notion of arms control, translation, cutbacks on American arms back in the 1970s, 80s. And when he was coming up in politics, one of his boosters was a group called the Council for a Livable World, which had been founded by a known socialist and perhaps Soviet agent by the name of Leo Szilard. This was their whole raison d'etre had to do with this particular issue. They seized on Biden early on in his career as a horse to ride and supported him. These were the kinds of issues he was known for early on, and these were the kinds of people who supported him. Al Gore Sr. was another a booster of Senator Biden, Al Gore Sr. being very infamous for his relationship with Armand Hammer, revealed by Edward J. Epstein to have been a Soviet asset of many years standing, even as he became known for being a philanthropist and a major businessman. I mean, you know, we can think of others in that category today, George Soros being one, so this is that tradition. So this is where he comes from. This is the cauldron. In those days, the Soviet Union was the strong horse. Now we're looking at China being the strong horse in the communist world.
His judgment has been flawed consistently, shall we say. And in these matters of national security, it's particularly alarming. And I think it's very helpful to have these choices defined as clearly as we can. Diana West, thank you so much for doing that with us. And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Thank you for being with us today. In the meantime, God bless you. Next up, we'll speak with Sam Faddis. We'll get a little bit more of a take on what else is going on in this space with respect to the penetration by the Chinese of our capital markets and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for one of our periodic visits with an amazing Renaissance man who has served his country in a variety of capacities and is continuing to do so, I'm very pleased to say. He has been an Army officer. He has been in the Judge Advocate General branch of the United States Army. He has also been an undercover clandestine service officer in the Central Intelligence Agency, finishing up his career in the agency with directing its Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Unit. He has gone on to other things, including a run for Congress. He's written a number of very impressive books, both fiction and nonfiction, and he is a fabulous guest. His name is Charles Sam Faddis, and we're always delighted to have him in the house virtually. Sam, welcome back. I was talking with Diane West a moment ago about some of the interesting things that Donald Trump spoke about in the Rose Garden yesterday about China. Sam, you are also a member of our Committee on the Present Danger of China, for which I'm very grateful. You have deep experience, of course, dealing with Marxist and other totalitarian enemies of this country. And when you hear that the United States capital markets are deeply penetrated by companies like the ones the president was asked about yesterday, defense companies of China, and others, by the way, that, you know, violate human rights or have been sanctioned by the United States government for various reasons or are, you know, simply illegal to do business with. What's going on here and what should we be doing about it?
Well, Frank, I think this is one of these situations where what you need to do is just kind of say, wait a second, let's just stop, regroup, revisit, and just kind of let's get back to reality. We've been fed a line for decades now that somehow we're dealing with communist China, but it's really not communism, or it's communism light, and it's really not a threat, and it's okay. And we've been fed that line because a lot of people have made a lot of money, ungodly sums of money, by doing business with the communists. Okay, let's just get back to reality. This is a brutal, totalitarian, communist regime that seeks to become the dominant power on the planet at our expense. So from that baseline, it is insane, literally self-destructive madness, for us to be assisting them in this process by giving them money, by facilitating them at our expense. So, my God, should we be pumping money into their economy, particularly the national security elements? By no means, and we should never have done that, ever.
So there's another component of this, which one of our colleagues, Rick Manning of Americans for Limited Government, wrote to the Labor Department about recently, and you helped distribute it, I think, through End Magazine and your other outlets. This is an appeal to stop having pension funds investing in slave labor operations in communist China. Again, these are affronts on so many different levels. I personally think the one that you mentioned a moment ago is particularly important, that it's detrimental to our national security. But even if that's not your passion, the fact that we are helping enable the exploitation of slave labor. The last time I checked here, we're talking a lot about, you know, slavery and how horrible it is and how it mustn't be tolerated. And yet apparently it's okay if the Han Chinese do it to Uyghurs or to, you know, their fellow Chinese for that matter. What, again, would you say, Sam Faddis, if you were talking to, well, Joe Biden, for example, who has a record, as President Trump made clear yesterday in the Rose Garden, of, well, at best, turning a blind eye to this, and at worst, actually enabling it, as he seeks the presidency of the United States at this point? What should his policy be, for heaven's sakes?
Well, I mean, at this point, I think if you look in the dictionary under the word hypocrite, you're going to see a picture of Joe Biden, quite frankly. I mean, the man, as you say, is affiliated with all sorts of concerns about reparations for slavery in this country from centuries ago, and that for decades has been part and parcel of this process of ignoring what the Chinese do. Slave labor is not incidental in China. It's a massive business. It goes beyond that to harvesting of organs from live victims to sell for hard foreign currency. It's a horror movie, and we ought to be, I mean, as hard over as we possibly can. If we, I mean, that, you know, we need to climb completely out of bed with these guys so that we are free to completely sanction them in the same way we sanction people like the Iranians. We have gone down a path we never should have gone down, and we need to get out of there.
And the corruption of so many in our elites, as we're seeing in the opposition to these sorts of course corrections, is a truly critical problem. So these sorts of course corrections, yes, are needed, but we're going to have to really mobilize the American people if they're going to overcome those who are enriching themselves from the present course and putting us all at risk in the process. Sam, let me turn to another bad actor the president mentioned as well yesterday in the form of Venezuela. He spoke about what it had become as a result of the policies of communists, socialists and communists, whatever you want to call them, doing business under one brand or another doesn't really matter. It's the same policy, ultimately. It is this domination for the purposes of control of masses of people and their resources that inevitably winds up destroying both. And the president was right to point that out. But you were talking about Nicolas Maduro in a recent piece, and I wanted you to visit about that against the backdrop of what Maduro is up to, among other things, in supporting Black Lives Matter at the moment here inside the United States, and what that tells us about BLM.
Yeah, well, of course, Maduro and Chavez before him, I mean, the entire crowd had destroyed what was once upon a time one of the most prosperous nations in South America. I mean, a very rich, prosperous nation with huge oil reserves. They've managed through their policies to destroy it and condemn something like 80-90% of the population to poverty. They've been indicted from top to bottom for running a gigantic drug cartel, which the Department of Justice explicitly says had the purpose not only of making money, but of deliberately using drugs as a weapon against the United States. That's right in the formal charging documents for Maduro and company. And yeah, he's cozied up to, at a minimum, a whole host of key figures in Black Lives Matter and other organizations. I mean, it has become almost a pilgrimage site for a lot of these American Marxist groups to go down, praise Maduro and before him Chavez for the great things they were doing while they're, of course, brutally suppressing their own people and driving them into poverty. So he's a nasty character.
He is a nasty character. And I guess the question to you, Sam, is as you're watching this nasty character, and we'll be talking shortly with several of our guests about Iran, when you're looking at what Recep Tayyip Erdogan is doing in Turkey and what he aspires to do throughout much of, you know, the Middle East, North Africa, Europe even, Central Asia. You look at what Vladimir Putin is up to with his nuclear weapons buildup and saber-rattling, to say nothing of the Chinese. We're in a world of hurt at the moment. And as President Trump pointed out in the Rose Garden, one of the other choices that is before the American people this fall is between maintaining something that approaches, at least, it aspires to be what Ronald Reagan used to call peace through strength as our posture and policy, versus defunding the military, not just the police, but defunding the military, which apparently is part and parcel of the Democratic platform now under Vice President Biden. Would you talk through what that portends if such adversaries, as I just mentioned, take away from it that we're going out of business in terms of our national security?
Well, the great thing about Joe Biden, if I can use that expression kind of sarcastically or tongue-in-cheek, is that you don't have to wonder at all about what his policies are going to be, right? The man's been in public office for decades, and he was the vice president under Barack Obama, so I think you pretty much have seen his resume. So you just listed off a whole host of threats, and you know definitively that the Biden play on all of these things will be to cave. I mean, you know, we're now arming the Ukrainians right on the Russian border. Barack and Joe couldn't manage to do that for 8 years. We're crushing the Iranian economy. Their plan was to give them $155 billion. We could walk on down this list. I mean, a Joe Biden presidency means, oh my God, we have emboldened it. So a Joe Biden presidency is emboldening all of these people and pouring jet fuel on these fires all over the world. That's what it means.
To our detriment, to the detriment of our friends and allies, and to freedom, I think, and the free world as well. These are the times that try men's souls, needless to say. Sam Faddis, you're one of the men that we rely on to hold the line, and thank you for doing that with us on a regular basis. We so appreciate your visits as well as your continuing service to our country in addition to that that you've rendered in the past. Keep it up, my friend, at andmagazine.com, among other places. Check it out for the writings of Sam Faddis and much more. We'll talk with you again very soon, Sam. Next up, we will speak with Ken Timmerman, an investigative journalist, about what's going on, among other places, in Iran at the moment. That may actually be a good thing for us. Not so good for the mullahs, though, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is a delight to say we're joined for the first time stateside for some time by Kenneth Timmerman, a man that we visit with from time to time, not as often as I'd like, frankly, but he is an extraordinary resource for us and for freedom-loving people all over, including in France, in which he found himself confined for some 4.5 months due to the coronavirus business. But he is back now with us, and we're very pleased to have him. Ken is an internationally recognized investigative reporter with some extraordinary scoops to his credit. He is also an author of both fiction and nonfiction works of some renown. And he is not least the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, a role for which he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. It's always good to have him with us. Ken, again, welcome home. Listen, in your absence, there has been some rather extraordinary revolutionary activity taking place in the streets of cities across our country. And you have written about one of the entities that has been a prime mover behind that rioting and violence and mayhem, a group called Antifa. And in Front Page magazine last month, you described it as, quote, an integral part of the Democrats' 2020 playbook, unquote. Tell us about that.
Well, look, the Democrats are intending to win the elections in 2020, no matter what it takes. And that means using violence, if necessary, through Antifa, creating chaos around the United States. That means, I believe, massive election fraud as well. I've written in my new book, The Election Heist, a scenario of how this could play out. And I look at all of the vulnerabilities of even our electronic voting systems, the ones that have been revised, updated, where you scan your paper ballot. They are not secure. They are not secure. As a source of mine, a friend in one of the alphabet soup agencies of our government told me, if it is controlled by software, it can be hacked. And those paper ballot systems are, all of them, controlled by software. So I am very worried about election fraud. I am very worried about Antifa. And don't think that Antifa is going away. Antifa is gearing up for the post-election season. The fact that they're not demonstrating today doesn't mean anything. It means that they're preparing, they're organizing, and they're organizing across the country. Again, in my book, The Election Heist, I look at how they will be used strategically to create chaos in cities of states where the vote is being recounted, because there will be recounts in a number of states, and the election is not going to be decided on November 7th. So Antifa is a key piece of the Democrats' playbook to steal the election in 2020.
It's also been identified as a Marxist enterprise. The anti-fascist thing is, of course, to conceal its true orientation and history. Are you seeing, Ken Timmerman, in the Democratic Party today, people who are actually so enthralled with and engaged in and associated with and supportive of Marxism, that they would actually be prepared to use a violent Marxist organization to try to attack and otherwise, influence the election?
I hate to say so, but yes, I think there is a new generation of Democrats, younger members of Congress in particular, who do not love this country, who do not even understand the Constitution, let alone respect the Constitution. I'm not sure that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has ever read the Constitution of the United States of America or the Declaration of Independence. And they believe that we are not just a flawed country, but an evil country. And an evil country deserves to be overturned. It deserves to be undone by whatever means necessary. We heard Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez the other night on television trying to explain away people who were robbing and stealing and shoplifting because they couldn't put food on the table. And she said, well, that's okay. You know, you got to understand where these people are coming from. So that is just a small example. But yes, I think there are people in the Democrat Party who believe that they must win this election or America will perish, which means that America will continue as it is today. They do not want that. They think that is America perishing. Right? It will not be fundamentally transformed as they wish.
Hey, and Ken, before we change topics here, I just wanted to say, I haven't seen the new book, The Election Heist. Is it fiction or is it nonfiction? Or is it fiction, as is so often the case with you, that's very much tied to nonfiction events and circumstances? In this case, the upcoming election, I assume.
Well, I call it an entertainment. It's going to be released on August 11th, and I will make sure you get your fresh copy as soon as possible, Frank. But it is a fictional scenario with two characters who are running against each other in a congressional election. One is the incumbent. He knows he's going to lose. So he makes a Faustian bargain with the National Party, the presidential campaign, which has a secret program to flip the election in key states so they will win no matter what happens.
This sounds all too plausible, and I know, as always, Ken Timmerman, that you have done your homework, and you have brought that to bear in a way that will be a powerful warning, I hope. And I hope as well that you will come back on the program for an hour to really talk us through what the book envisions and recommends. But in the meantime, let me turn to Iran, as this is, of course, a subject on which you are deeply knowledgeable and in which you have been very actively engaged for many, many years, specifically warning against and seeking to replace the, well, mullahocracy, I call it. We're going to talk a little bit about this with David Wormser again, by way of an update. But give us your reading, Ken, as to what's going on with these serial explosions that seem to be, purely coincidentally, I'm sure, in an awful lot of places that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and the regime have been doing dangerous things.
Yes, such as making nuclear weapons and building long-range ballistic missiles to hit Israel and ultimately the United States. Yeah, but they've also, here's what's interesting, they've also been hitting civilian infrastructure targets. And there is a notion that's been flying around recently, both in Israel and in Iran, among national security analysts, that there's a kind of tit-for-tat war between, cyber war between Israel and Iran. The Iranians hacked an Israeli water facility earlier and gas facility in April of this year and did some serious damage. And after that, you saw these attacks on civilian infrastructure plants, for example, a chlorine filtration plant for drinking water, where they reversed the valves through a cyber attack. And that, you know, poisoned the water, essentially, with too much chlorine. I think there's also another aspect to this, potentially. A group called the Homeland Cheetahs has claimed responsibility. They claim to be a group of Iranian national security officers, intelligence officers, and cyber officers who feel that the regime
has become a kleptocracy, not just a mollocracy, but a kleptocracy, robbing the people of the resources. And I would not put it past, I know an awful lot of very smart people in Iran, very, very sophisticated when it comes to cyber and cyber attacks. Many of them today are unemployed. They do not have real jobs, or when they are they are also sometimes forced to work for the regime on projects attacking, which means hacking U.S. infrastructure or U.S. banks or other facilities around the world, and they don't like that. So there is the possibility that there's some homegrown element to this as well.
But it's a homegrown element that seeks the downfall of the regime, or they seek simply to have it behave rather differently, but still remain fundamentally a Sharia supremacist totalitarian system?
Unclear. We don't know enough about them yet. They have just emerged. They have one manifesto that was sent to Iranian media and has leaked out to world media. They also claim, here, interestingly, that the regime's leaders are becoming like the Shah. So they are anti-Shah, anti-royalist as well. So this is not a royalist plot. It is some kind of, I believe, homegrown nationalist movement inside the Reb Guards.
Two quick questions in closure. Would you say that the likelihood is that the Israelis are behind these attacks, or is the so-called MEK being used by others perhaps to accomplish them?
The MEK doesn't have any capability, so I don't believe that they could actually carry out something like this. But the Israelis could, because the Israelis do have a very, very serious cyber capability, they could carry out attacks like this and then attribute them to the MEK. It would not be the first time. In 2002, when the MEK revealed the existence of these secret nuclear plants that later became known to the world, admitted to the world, it was actually the Israelis that had uncovered them. And they gave it to the MEK because no other Iranian opposition group wanted to have that close association with Israel. They were afraid of being tarred with that brush. So it wouldn't be the first time.
Fascinating. We'll talk more about this with David Wormser. But in the meantime, Ken Timmerman, thank you. Again, we look forward to the election heist. I assume it can be purchased in advance now on Amazon. Is that right?
It can, and it's tremendously important for people to do so, because that it tells Amazon to have copies on hand so they don't run out, as they generally do.
Ken Timmerman, thank you so much for your time today and your great service to us in so many different respects. Let's keep it up. Talk to you soon. Next up, as promised, David Wormser of the Center for Security Policy will drill down further on what's going on in Iran and what it might mean for us and what we should be doing to help bring about the end of this regime in Tehran. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we are joined once again by a friend and colleague of many years. His name is David Wormser. He is these days the director of the Center for Security Policy's new program on fighting global anti-Semitism and defending the U.S.-Israel relationship. David has served his country in a number of capacities over the years, including rising through the ranks of the United States Navy to that of lieutenant commander with a specialization in intelligence. He served as an advisor to former National Security Advisor John Bolton, and also as an assistant for Middle East affairs with then Vice President Richard Cheney. It's so good to have him with us. David, as always, thank you for joining us, especially at a moment when some very important things are happening in your portfolio. Well, we were talking a moment ago with Ken Timmerman about Iran, and I want to follow up with you again. David, you've been keeping us abreast over the past few weeks about this series of mysterious explosions that have been taking place, as we talked about with Ken and, among other places, facilities associated with the regime's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile activities. You have written in Asia Times recently that these are signs of perhaps, quote, Iran's regime is facing collapse, unquote. Tell us why you think so, and at whose hands, David?
Well, it's a very good question. One of the things that I've noticed about these series of events, which started on June 26th, and we've seen a number of them that hit their very sensitive military sites, and some that have hit major infrastructure sites that have strategic importance. One thing I've noticed about them, though, is that there really is this character that's developing in all these strikes or accidents or whatever one would want to call them. There really is this atmosphere of impotence that the Iranian government is displaying. Every Iranian had already become really accustomed to the idea that corruption was so rampant that there was an amazing incompetence everywhere. But now, all of a sudden, added to it, the incompetence has become so deep that they look impotent. Iranians are not going to believe that all this is just a coincidence. They're going to see a hidden hand behind it, whether it's the Americans, the Israelis, the opposition. And every day this will be poured into that filter of an emerging concept of a conspiracy. In a good way for us, that the regime cannot handle it. The regime has no ability to stop it. We had two more incidents over the last 24 to 36 hours. Yesterday, a major petrochemical plant in Mashhad burned down. And this morning, we still don't know the extent of it, but at least three ships, big ships, went up in flames. In Bushehr port, the fire is currently out of control. They're worried about it spreading toward the city. And it's where they build some of their speedboats and so forth for their navy. We don't know what the parameters of this fire are other than it's huge. So the government just looks really weak. Then on top of it, they're not able to pay their people. You have industries across Iran 3-4 months late on payments, private industries. So you have a lot of demonstrations attending all this. And then finally, you have a currency collapse going on. Iran's rial went down basically by 1/5 over the last week. So imagine if you woke up today and what was a week ago a dollar is all of a sudden $1.20. Your mortgage, gas, food, everything you do in life is suddenly 20% more.
David, one of the things that came to mind when you talked about not being able to pay people is there are large numbers of people that the Iranians have been paying for decades, in some cases, like Hezbollah, and of course the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is an economic, force in its own right. But these are people who, if they don't get paid, can, be a problem for the regime, no? And if so, is there some basis for believing that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps may see this as the moment to seize power through a coup?
Well, yes, absolutely. What you see are Iranians themselves are frustrated. They feel all their money is going to Gaza, to Syria. And many of these demonstrations, you see the chant, why Gaza, no to Gaza, no to Syria. We want Iran for Iran, which is they're upset that all this money is going abroad to those proxy forces when Iranians are literally economically collapsing. It's exacerbated by this Iran deal with China right now, where the Iranians feel the government now has economically reached such a desperate point that they're essentially selling the country to China, including Kish Island oil terminals and so forth. So there's this feeling that the despair and, again, this incompetence of the regime is leading Iran to surrender their future. And that's really angering Iranians. The Revolutionary Guard has picked up on this. They have been publicly blasting the current government. And this could all be preparations for them trying to assert themselves and have sort of a putsch.
Now, needless to say, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps has been the creature of and sustaining force behind this regime for years. So were they to pull the plug, presumably you'd see a collapse of this government, but not necessarily an improvement in terms of what comes next. I note as we speak, David, you will be talking this afternoon with our good friend and often a very important contributor to this program, Dr. Harold Rode, about Israeli-Iranian relations after all of this comes to pass, after the mullahs. But what book are you making at the moment as to what comes next? And what can the United States be doing to try to shape that so that it's the best outcome for the Iranian people as well as for us?
What I think we're seeing in the next few months is a likely assertion of power by the IRGC. However, the IRGC itself is not able to handle this situation effectively. They're the ones who really were behind all this going on in Syria and Gaza. They're the ones who really are behind the China deal. They're the ones who really have essentially confiscated the entire Iranian economy away from any productive sector and enriched themselves personally. So I think what you're seeing is, I'd be very careful of analogies, but then I'm going to go make one myself, which is really the Soviet Union in the end of days. There was an assertion of the old guard at the very end, but it only precipitated the collapse. You have a lot of vultures circling around the corpse, and every one of the vultures is sort of looking at it and thinking, when will that other one make the move? And I need to preempt them. So the moment one makes a move, the frenzy begins. And I think that's the phase we're beginning to enter with the Iranian regime right now.
This can get very messy, needless to say, and anytime you think you're going to actually have a say in how this turns out, you're likely to be wrong. But are there things, David Wormser, that the United States government could quietly, perhaps behind the scenes, surreptitiously be doing to improve the prospects that we don't simply see an even worse outcome in the form of the IRGC or some new totalitarian figure emerging, especially presumably with the help of the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, I think all along one of the key factors here is what Nathan Sharansky once told us about the way the dissidents looked at the situation in Russia during the Cold War. Moral clarity. It is imperative at this point that the Iranian people think that we are on their side against the regime, and that we're not putting the screws on the regime only to make a better deal. It's important for our politics not to go for an overt regime change strategy, because we are tired of wars and people don't want to get involved in another one. And I certainly don't think we should get involved in one in Iran right now. But I think we should maximize the pressure on the regime. And I believe the way to do so is to make it clear to the Iranian people we're on their side and that we're supporting whoever's doing some of these regime destabilizing activities. And if it's Israel, we probably already are doing something with them.
This is a fascinating moment, David Wormser. You've been in key positions in our government in other challenging times, and your expertise and insights into this one are really appreciated, and so is the work you're doing at the Center for Security Policy. People can find the video of your webinar with Harold Rode at securefreedom.org, and you can follow David Wormser's writings there as well. Thank you, my friend. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.